Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Lakatos Award Lecture. The Lakatos Award is made in recognition of an outstanding contribution to the philosophy of science in the form of a book. This year, that award has been carried off jointly by two very distinguished philosophers, and our speaker this evening, Professor Alexander Rosenberg of the University of California, Riverside, is one of them. The presentation to Professor Rosenberg of the award will take place after this lecture at a reception in the senior common room, and you're welcome to attend that. In these days, when economists occupy such influential positions, and when economics as a discipline is so central to our lives and the way we are governed, and not, it would seem, with unqualified success, we are entitled to ask, what is the intellectual status of economic assumptions and economic laws? These are the kinds of questions that have largely occupied Alexander Rosenberg. For 15 or more years, his has been one of the most influential voices in the philosophy of economics. In 1976, he published a book, Microeconomic Laws, a Philosophical Analysis, which was his first major investigation in the area. And his latest book, which is his sixth, and is the book for which he won the Lakatos Award, represents a further development of his ideas. The book is called Economics, Mathematical Politics, or Science of Diminishing Returns? As the title suggests, it comes to some fairly somber conclusions about the scientific status of economics and its laws. This evening, Professor Rosenberg's lecture, which I'm sure will be far from somber, will deal with some of these questions. He'll talk for about 60 minutes, and after that he's agreed to answer questions put to him by you. Professor Rosenberg, I'm delighted to welcome you to the school and to invite you to give your talk called What Kind of Theory is Economic Theory?
Thank you. I'm aware that if I deserve this award at all, it's for my work in the philosophy of science. It's only because, along with Martin Hollis, I was the first of my generation to undertake a philosophical study of economics, and because I've done my best to encourage economists and other philosophers to join me in this now flourishing enterprise. I owe thanks to these scholars, and I'm going to name several of them, some names that will be familiar to you and others not. Dan Hausman, Alan Nelson, Mark Blaug, Martin Hollis, Roy Weintraub, Wade Hans, Bruce Caldwell, Margaret Chabas, Mary Morgan of this school, Amartya Sen, Hal Varian, Alan Gibbard. I owe thanks to these scholars, and I owe thanks to the teacher who encouraged me to work in this area, and whom happily the LSE honors this year for his contribution to a more venerable tradition, the philosophy of physics. It doubles my pleasure that I should have shared this year's Lakatos Award with my dissertation director, Peter Achenstein. My talk comes in five parts. Part one, introduction. Economic theory is a perplexing subject. Though I have spent the better part of my academic career thinking about its aims and methods, I've never been confident that I, or anyone else for that matter, really understands its cognitive status. Partly, no doubt, this is because everyone's understanding of the cognitive status of most intellectual disciplines has been subject to great disturbance over the last 20 years or more. Even at the time I first began thinking and writing about the philosophy, the problems which economic theory presents for the philosophy of science in the late 60s, the conceptual framework within which scientific disciplines were assessed was coming under serious question. Since then, matters have moved so far in the philosophy, the history, the sociology, and the psychology of science that the very notion of cognitive status has gone rather into eclipse. Over the same period that philosophy's sense of certainty about what science is has disappeared, the philosophy of economics has emerged as a growth industry, and many people are now quite confident they understand the aims and methods of the discipline. However, my view about the nature of economic theory has remained permanently unsettled. Since the appearance of my first book, Microeconomic Laws, about the only things that have remained fixed in my approach to this subject are the questions with which I started. Questions about the cognitive status of economic theory. That is, questions about whether the theory is to be understood and assessed for adequacy along the lines of theory in the sciences, physical, biological, and behavioral. Over the years since I wrote Microeconomic Laws, these questions about cognitive significance have not been popular. But I have stuck with them, largely because an answer to the question can have significant ramifications for public policy, for our hopes to improve its intended effects and to mitigate its unintended ones. If economics is a science, if its theories are composed of improvable regularities about human behavior and its aggregate consequences, then its bearing on policy is as evident as the bearing of physiology is on human health. If not, confidence reposed in it will be repaid by frustration at best. Without some assurance about the cognitive status of the theory, there is no basis for confidence in it. Now, the trouble with this question about the cognitive status of economic theory is that in the philosophy of science, there is no longer any conviction about the existence of a litmus test which will indicate the cognitive status of a theory. Though some economists still pay lip service to Popper's litmus test of falsifiability, most students of the philosophy of economics recognize that A, economic theory is not in fact falsifiable, and B, falsifiability is unacceptable as a test for the scientific respectability of any theory. But no adequate substitute litmus test has been found. The absence of such a test has led some students, I have in mind Donald McCloskey, to conclude that there are in fact no differences in the cognitive status of economics, physics, mathematics, literary criticism, astrology, for that matter. While I recognize that there is no litmus test here, I persist in believing that there are important differences between the cognitive statuses of these various enterprises, especially all of the first five and astrology on the other hand. It's just very difficult to establish what these differences are. When I wrote Microeconomic Laws, I argued that there was no conceptual obstacle to microeconomic theory status as a body of contingent laws about the causes of choice behavior and its aggregate consequences. In the years since I wrote that book, I have not changed my mind on this score, but I have come to believe that this conclusion takes us only a very little way towards understanding the nature of economic theory. Treating economic theory as a contingent theory about the causes and consequences of choice behavior will not explain the attachment of economists to the theory, because it is just not a very good explanatory theory of the causes and consequences of economic choice. For the same reason, treating it as a succession of abstract models of largely instrumental significance won't do either. For over the course of a century, it has failed to explain economic processes with anything like improving accuracy and precision. Economic theory seems permanently stuck at the level of what I have called generic prediction. Generic predictions are ones that tell us that some change will happen sometime and someplace, without ever telling us when and where and how much of a change will occur. Generic predictions are of considerable value. They are better than no predictions at all. But for most scientific disciplines, they have been only way stations on the path towards specific predictions. Specific predictions tell us not just whether something will happen, but when and where and to what extent. In fact, once a discipline hits its theoretical stride, generic prediction is no longer possible alone. A theory will only make a generic prediction by stripping away the details from its specific predictions. Economic theory has never seemed able to improve its large numbers of generic predictions in the direction of exactly when, where, and by how much. Indeed, latter-day apologists for economic theory insist that economic theory need not improve its predictive powers beyond the generic, because it is in the nature of such predictions to be suicidally self-refuting the moment they gain wide visibility. If this is true, it must be cold comfort to economists. For a theory that cannot predict, cannot explain, or at any rate, we have no way of telling whether its explanations are correct and no reasons to parlay its explanations into policy prescriptions. In recent years, I've begun to think that we need to seek non-explanatory rationales for the continuing commitment of economists to economic theory. In this talk, I'll sketch two such rationales. First, the idea that economic theory is fundamentally a normative discipline. Second, and more briefly, the notion that economic theory is a branch of applied mathematics. In neither case will we impose explanatory demands on economic theory, or predictive ones for that matter. Part two, economics as normative. Let's consider whether the rationale for economic theory might in the end be normative. This is not a particularly new idea in the philosophy of social science, or even in the philosophy of economics. It has often been held that theories in the social disciplines are normative because they are about action, or otherwise you use a vocabulary that is evaluative. For example, it is held that economics is a body of prescriptions for how to be rational, and rationality is taken to be a normative concept. So viewed, of course, economic theory, and any normative theory for that matter, is beyond the criticism that it is predictively weak or otherwise defective as empirical science. But this is little consolation because normative claims are also irrelevant to the explanation of actual behavior. But there's another more interesting way of arguing that economic theory is fundamentally part of a normative enterprise, one which really does shed light on its character, and sheds light especially on the theoretical core of microeconomic theory, general equilibrium analysis. In what follows, I sketch what such an interpretation looks like. The rationale I sketch helps itself to the historically most compelling of all strategies for the establishment of political philosophies, the social contract. One hint that social contractarianism may be a useful way of approaching the aims and claims of general equilibrium theory is to observe how much political philosophy, and especially contractarian political theory, has been influenced by economic theory in the last two decades. Many philosophers have simply taken over the jargon and the agenda of welfare economics in order to express their problems and seek solutions to them. In particular, the recognition that the establishment of cooperative institutions as a public goods problem has driven philosophers to explore economists' ways of solving such public goods problems. Perhaps philosophers' enchantment with welfare economics for their purposes reflects a belated recognition that we can also expect economists explicitly to endorse, that economic general competitive equilibrium theory is a species of formal political philosophy. Hereafter, I drop the qualifier competitive equilibrium, since most general equilibrium models reflect this, the feature that I shall treat below. What is so seductive about general equilibrium theory is that it is a formal proof of an apparently surprising possibility. As Arrow and Hahn have noted, and here I quote from Arrow and Hahn, the immediate common sense answer to the question, what will an economy motivated by individual greed and controlled by a very large number of different agents look like, is probably, there will be chaos, end quote. The response is right, and it is probably the chief source of the attractions of a centrally planned economy, one in which the planners can reconcile everyone's conflicting wants and decide on a schedule of production that meets those wants optimally, given the constraint of available resources. Let's hazard a guess that most intelligent persons thinking abstractly about the need for coordination, efficiency, and equity in a society will be attracted to some form of central planning. Arrow and Hahn, however, note in a tone of understatement and technicality that the contrary is the case. Here again I quote, a decentralized economy motivated by self-interest and guided by price signals would be compatible with a coherent disposition of economic resources that could be regarded, here's where the technicality and the qualifications come in, that could be regarded in a well-defined sense as superior to a large class of possible alternative dispositions. It is important to understand how surprising this claim must be to anyone not exposed to this tradition. End of quote. Now imagine a large number of rational agents who have already come to agreement about the advantages each will accrue from the existence of a state with political authority to coerce each of them as necessary to enforce rules on which they have already agreed, a social contract. Having agreed on political rules, these individuals fall to arguing about what commercial institutions they will establish, what arrangements will recommend themselves. Given the assumption contractarian political philosophy makes that they are rational and not altruistic in their preferences, and given some undeniable facts about information, incentives, and scarcity, it is not difficult to establish the preferability for society as a whole of decentralized market mechanisms over centrally planned ones. Except in the case of public goods, what seems most remarkable about a market economy is that by accepting the inevitability of short-term surpluses and shortfalls, it does better at mitigating them than a planned economy. That is, it not only avoids shortages and surpluses more frequently, but when it does result in them, they are smaller. If we can prove that by arranging a scheme that will mitigate gluts and shortages to the maximum extent, we do better than we would if we simply aimed directly at eliminating surpluses and deficits through central collection of information and rational planning in the use of it, we will have provided a powerful incentive for rational agents to adopt such a scheme. If we can show that there is too much information from consumers and producers for a planner to process, and too much information that consumers and producers have an incentive to hide, so that gluts and shortages will be inevitable, and that a market mechanism takes advantage of both of these facts about information, then we'll have little difficulty convincing the parties to a social contract that the market is the way to go. These are the kinds of considerations that seduce intelligent young minds from socialism to capitalism. Because these considerations work, because they actually move people, we should accord them considerable respect in any account of why general equilibrium analysis has any claim on our attention. Even when we recognize that general equilibrium's relevance to explaining market processes in the actual world is very limited. For general equilibrium theory is the formalized approach to the systematic study of this claim about how the unintended consequences of uncoordinated selfishness result in the most efficient exploitation of scarce resources in the satisfaction of wants. It is, of course, an inquiry with many limitations. But at least we can understand why economists might continue to lavish attention on general equilibrium theory. It's not because they think it can be improved in the direction of a descriptively and predictively accurate explanation of economic activity, but because it's already part of the best contractarian argument for the adoption of the market as a social institution. Consider general equilibrium theory as one important component in the research program of contractarian political philosophy. Doing so helps us explain two other features of neoclassical theory: its remarkably a priori character, and the temptation felt by philosophers, among others, to view it as a body of prescriptions about rational conduct. In effect, this approach to general equilibrium assimilates neoclassical economics to what James Buchanan identifies as one of its two subdivisions, constitutional. Economic analysis and constitutional economic analysis. Here's a quote from Buchanan. Orthodox economic analysis, whether this be interpreted in Marshallian or Walrasian terms, attempts to explain the choices of economic agents, their interactions with one another, and the results of these interactions. So far, I have to disagree with Buchanan, for interpreted as an explanatory project, orthodox economic analysis, or its core at any rate, just isn't explanatory. It won't explain the choices of individual agents. But Buchanan goes on, here again I quote, "By contrast, constitutional economic analysis attempts to explain the working properties of alternative sets of legal, institutional, political rules that constrain the choices and the activities of economic agents, the rules that define the framework within which ordinary choices of economic and political agents are made. The whole exercise of constitutional economic analysis is aimed at offering guidance to those who participate in discussions of constitutional change. Constitutional economics offers a potential for normative advice to members of the Constitutional Convention. It examines the choice of constraints as opposed to the choice within constraints." End of quote from Buchanan. But to decide on the choice of constraints, we need information about the effects of choice within those constraints. To the extent that orthodox economic theory provides information about those choices within constraints, it will be a component of what Buchanan calls orthodox economic analysis. But suppose the only information it reliably provides is information relevant to the choice among constraints, that is, to what rules rational agents would contract were they required to do so. Then there would be no other role for what Buchanan calls orthodox economic analysis except constitutional economic analysis. Now, the doubts about the explanatory relevance of general equilibrium theory suggest that it cannot explain much about choice within constraints. That's, so to speak, how the problem of justifying general equilibrium theory gets started, and the problem of understanding what its cognitive status is. But these doubts are irrelevant to its role in a search for optimal constraints. For in this search, there is every reason to assume that agents ruthlessly maximize their utilities everywhere and always, that they dissimulate whenever it is to their advantage, free ride when they can. For this is just the sort of behavior against which a polity must protect itself. Therefore, as Hume writes, and as Buchanan is fond of quoting, political writers have established it as a maxim that in contriving any system of government and fixing the several checks and controls of that institution, every man ought to be supposed to be a knave and to have no other end in his actions than private interest. So David Hume. There is, in other words, a prudential argument that for purposes of institution design, we treat all agents as utility maximizers and assure ourselves that each of us is willing to live with the consequences of doing so. The prudential requirement is honored in an especially clear and powerful way by general equilibrium theory, as its game theoretical development reveals. As histories of general equilibrium theory make clear, it was early recognized that the existence of a general equilibrium was also the solution to an n-person generalization of the von Neumann-Morgenstern solution for a two-person zero-sum competitive game. Arrow and de Brieux's version of this realization is particularly instructive for the assimilation of general equilibrium to a contractarian agenda. We're given two kinds of agents, price-taking, budget-constrained utility maximizers, and one omniscient auctioneer, the Walrasian auctioneer, whose only aim is to minimize excess demand among the other agents. The auctioneer announces price vectors for which the other agents each announce their best response. The auctioneer chooses one price, which clears the markets most fully. His position is little different from Hobbes's sovereign. The auctioneer and his institution are thus shown to be the most advantageous arrangement parties to a contract about the rules for economic activity can adopt in the abstract. For the equilibrium whose existence it establishes can be shown to be a Nash equilibrium, one in which each such egotistical agent has an optimal strategy, regardless of the strategies of the other agents. The market in which an equilibrium producing price vector exists is thus has an especially desirable property from the point of view of contractarian political philosophy. No one can do better by adopting another strategy, and the strategies result in an informationally efficient market clearing Pareto optimal unique and stable equilibrium. It remains possible on this view to cavil at the abstractness of general equilibrium theory, at the demanding assumptions required to prove that there is a market-clearing price vector. But the evident desirability of such a price vector makes it worth attempting to identify the institutional constraints under which the desirable equilibrium is attainable, no matter how unbridled the egoism of Hume's knave. But, one can ask, can a theory which is predictively weak really carry the normative burden that general equilibrium is saddled with by this interpretation? The question reflects an objection to treating general equilibrium theory as a species of political philosophy. As the solution to a set of normative problems, general equilibrium theory still needs to have some measure of relevance to actual choice. After all, ought implies can. And if we ought to adopt institutions that approach those of markets that general equilibrium describes, then it must be the case that we can do so. But we have no assurance of this possibility unless economic theory has a certain amount of explanatory and predictive power. If the actions it counsels are beyond us, it is irrelevant as moral philosophy. If rational choices are within our abilities, then the fact that we do not seem to engage in these activities fully enough to give the theory much empirical warrant must reduce its normative bearing as well. I'll return to this question in a few pages. Part 3, intentionality and information in generic economic theory. Meanwhile, If anything makes constitutional economics a more promising discipline than what Buchanan calls orthodox economic analysis, it is the role of information in economic behavior and its role in the untractability of economic theory. Economic theory is doomed to at most generic predictions, predictions that some change will happen, but not exactly when or how much of one, because it cannot adequately measure the values of its explanatory variables, preferences and expectations. Those are the explanatory variables of economic theory. And economic theory cannot look to other disciplines, like psychology, to measure these variables more accurately. It cannot do this even if economists were willing to admit the relevance of psychology to their discipline, something they have resolutely refused to do, at least since economic theory took on its present shape. Explaining why psychology cannot help economics more accurately measure preferences and expectations, or changes in them, would take us straight into the depths of contemporary philosophy of psychology, an excursion that I want to postpone at least until the question period. Suffice it to say that the source of trouble for economic theory's attempts to find improvable laws of economic behavior is something that has only become clear in the philosophy of psychology's attempt to understand the intentional variables of common sense and cognitive psychology. Beliefs and desires, the terms which ordinary thought and the social sciences use to describe the causes and effects of human action, these do not describe natural kinds. They do not divide nature at the joint. And of course, belief and desire are just what in ordinary language we call preferences and expectations. Unlike gene or acid or electric charge, belief and desire, or in the economist's label, expectation and preference, do not label natural kinds, sets of items that behave in the same way, that share the same manageably small set of causes and effects, and so can be brought together in causal generalizations that improve on our ordinary level of prediction and control of human action, let alone attain the sort of continuing improvement characteristic of science. The intentional concepts are more like chair or fish, words that may very well be essential for the ordinary business of life, but are missing from any catalog of the basic kinds recognized in scientific theories. Because of the character of our intentional variables, we can't expect to improve our intentional explanations of actions beyond their present levels of predictive power. But the level of predictive power of our intentional theory is no higher than it was in Plato's day. The predictive weakness of theories couched in intentional vocabulary reflects the fact that the terms of this vocabulary do not correlate in any manageable way with the vocabulary of other successful scientific theories. They don't divide nature at the joints, insofar as its joints are revealed in other successful theories, like those of, for example, neuroscience. The failure of microeconomic theory to uncover laws of human behavior is due to its wrongly assuming that these laws will trade in desires and beliefs or their cognates, preferences and expectations. And the system of propositions about markets and economies that economists have constructed on the basis of its assumptions about preferences and expectations is deprived of improving explanatory and predictive power in part because its assumptions can't be improved in a way that transmits improved precision to their consequences. Thus, the failure of economic theory to uncover laws is traced not to a conceptual mistake or to the inappropriateness to human action of constrained maximization theory and its elegant formalism, but to a false assumption economists share with all other social scientists, indeed with everyone who has ever explained their own or other people's behavior by appeal to the operation of beliefs and desires. Just as economists have been given no pause by previous analyses of the empirical weakness of their discipline, they are unlikely to down tools in the face of this diagnosis either. Indeed, the persistence of economists in pursuing the intentional approach that has been conventional for well over a century suggests that nothing could make them give it up. At any rate, nothing which would make empirical scientists give up a theory will make economists give up their theoretical strategy. But the unwillingness to surrender this conviction leads to the conclusion that economic theory is not empirical science at all. Again, the attitude and the interests of economic theorists are more consonant with those of political theorists, and in particular with contractarians among them, deriving institutional arrangements behind a veil of ignorance in an original position, a state of nature, or at least to forestall the worst-case scenario if everyone were, per impossibly, to be a rational agent. Let's stipulate, therefore, that no psychological theory of intentional variables will enable one to improve the accuracy of predictions of relevant beliefs and desires to rational agents beyond the level of common sense. And without increased accuracy in measurement of the causes of individual economic choice, there's no prospect for improvement in their prediction. Of course, if we could remain agnostic about the determinants of individual economic choice, while improving our predictions about aggregate and macroeconomic phenomena, economics wouldn't be relegated to at most generic predictions, and the scope for going beyond constitutional economics, beyond social contract-inspired institutional design, would be greater. Alas, the direction in which economic theory seems to be moving increasingly suggests that agnosticism about micromotives in the prediction of macro statistics is untenable. What is more, there are philosophical arguments, ones well known within the halls of the LSE, ones due in part to John Watkins, which purport to show that advice on institutional arrangements is the most that we could expect to arrange from economic theory. Economists have long excused themselves from any concern with improving our understanding of one of the two crucial variables of economic theory on the grounds of de gustibus non est disputandum. There's no accounting for taste. Tastes are entirely exogenous. But in a large enough population of consumers, say, for example, an infinite number, there should be enough stability in aggregate preferences over time so that individual differences will not matter for aggregate predictions. Furthermore, we can be confident that almost everyone shares some crucial preferences. We all want more money rather than less. So the exogeneity of preferences should not be a barrier to transcending generic predictions in the aggregate. But what of expectations? These too are beyond the reach of predictive improvement and more crucial in establishing the permanent predictive limitations of economic theory. To begin with, we know from the von Neumann-Morgenstern theory of choice under uncertainty that we can't establish the expectations of an agent without making precise assumptions about the agent's preferences. If we have already excluded considerations of the agent's preferences, if we've already excluded considerations of preference on the grounds that they are exogenous, we can't identify expectations either. On the other hand, if von Neumann and Morgenstern are right, we can establish the agent's preference structure, but only if we already know what their expectations are with considerable precision. Preferences are exogenous, but differences among them may cancel out. Expectations, or rather changes in expectations, the appearance of new information, are also exogenous. And even if we knew who acquired new information and how exactly it affects their choices, the improvement in economic theory would not get us beyond generic prediction. The reasons are twofold. Exogenous information is the chief source of disturbance in economic systems, the chief cause of their shift from one state of equilibrium, or disequilibrium for that matter, to another. And the rate at which information shocks to the economic system occur is accelerating. Second, the ability and the incentive of individual agents to exploit new information for their own advantage is increasing rapidly as the explosion of futures markets and commodities, financial instruments, and other items reveals. Technology is bringing the cost of acquiring information down and increasing the payoff to using it. Between them, the acceleration of exogenous information shocks and the influence of these shocks on aggregate outcomes makes the prospects for predictive improvement dim. It was Sir Karl Popper of this institution who first reported an outcome rather similar to this in the preface to The Poverty of Historicism. Sir Karl argued like this, one, and now I'm quoting from the preface, the course of human history is strongly influenced by the growth of human knowledge. Two, we cannot predict by rational or scientific means the future growth of our scientific knowledge. Three, we cannot therefore predict the future course of human history. This means, Sir Karl went on, this means we must reject the possibility of a theoretical history, that is to say, of a historical social science that would correspond to theoretical physics. There can be no scientific history of historical developments serving as a base for historical prediction. End of quote. Popper held that the decisive step in this argument was 2, the statement that we cannot predict by rational or scientific means the future growth of our scientific knowledge. He argued for this premise thus, again I'm quoting, "I think it is decisive in itself. If there is such a thing as growing human knowledge, then we cannot anticipate today what we shall know only tomorrow. This, I think, is sound reasoning, but it does not amount to a logical proof of the statement that we can't predict the growth of scientific knowledge. The proof," said Popper, "is more complicated. My proof consists in showing that no scientific predictor, whether a human scientist or a calculating machine, can possibly predict by scientific methods its own future results. Attempts to do so can attain their results only after the prediction has turned into a retrodiction. This argument, being purely logical," Popper went on, "applies to scientific predictors of any complexity, including societies of interacting predictors. But this means that no society can predict scientifically its own future states of knowledge." End of quote from The Poverty of Historicism. Popper concluded that what he called a science of history, akin to physical science, was impossible because historical processes were influenced by the accretion of scientific knowledge and that no one could predict changes in scientific knowledge. His argument for this latter claim was presumably that the only basis on which rationally to predict improvements in scientific knowledge are exactly the same bases on which to discover such improvements. Accordingly, anyone who could predict such improvements would be in a position to make them. If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Since there is no logic of scientific discovery, there is no predictive science of scientific advance. If we cannot foresee the advent of scientific change, and if it is a significant force in human history, we cannot foresee the direction of human history. QED. Or rather, Popper thought so. I'm not prepared to adopt this argument lock, stock, and barrel as an adequate explanation for the limitations on predictive improvement in the social sciences generally. For one thing, over long periods, the rate of scientific change has been slow enough safely to be neglected, and yet we still haven't gotten beyond generic prediction. For another, about the only thing that we can reliably predict is what will happen in countries innocent of Western science when they begin learning about it. But within the compass of economics, Popper's argument is very appealing. It should be clear that his argument will work not just for scientific theory, but for any sort of factual information whose arrival cannot be predicted and would make a difference for individual choice. In contexts where scientific change moves in as stately, if not a glacial pace, its role as an exogenous interference in prediction will be very limited, and presumably we may be able to improve our predictions of consequences of single significant scientific changes. But such limitations on the rate and role of information change are not to be met with in economic systems. Not only is the rate of arrival of economically valuable information high, but with increasing frequency, the impact on agents' choices of one dose of such information will be affected by another bit of information even before the choice is actually made, and so on in a continuous cascade of trajectory-changing exogenous shocks. Since almost anything in the environment may have an impact on expectations, and since the sensitivity of choices to these changes will increase as the cost of information processing decreases, economic outcomes must perforce become less and less open to prediction. So long as economic theory takes expectations seriously, it will be unable to do more than provide generic predictions. Here's a response on behalf of the defender of economic theory's power to provide specific and not merely generic predictions. In some areas, economic theory has been improving over the recent past and now threatens to transcend merely generic predictions. The areas in question are roughly on the intersection of game theory, the theory of bargaining, the theory of voting, the theory of committees. In fact, economists and political scientists have begun to turn their powers to produce well-confirmed specific predictions, not merely generic ones, into money returns by selling these applications of their theories to governments and to businesses. It certainly seems true that in some areas of imperfect competition, in which there are limited numbers of competitors, unambiguous objective functions, that is, goals each competitor sets as an objective, and reliable expectations about the strengths and weaknesses of competing agents, one party can sometimes predict the strategies of its competitors and devise an optimal strategy for itself. Choosing an optimal strategy requires a better than merely generic prediction about the choices of competitors. And in recent years, such predictions seem to have been available to some competitors. I believe this trend simply reflects the increased incentives that economic agents have to adopt economic theory as a normative prescription. As the costs of information gathering and its employment fall, and as the costs of failing to be rational in the narrow economist sense rise. What is more, the returns to employing game theories will only increase until all economic agents in the game begin to employ the same theory to make predictions about one another's best strategies. At this point, and it is a point that may be easily reached, the optimal strategy may turn out to simply be to return to flipping a coin or rolling dice to make a choice. Because if each party's best choice is a function of how others choose, and these choices can be predicted, the result will be that no choice is provably optimal. It will turn out that with common knowledge, the choices facing economic agents in imperfectly competitive situations will be like the old child's game of rock, paper, scissors, where there is no equilibrium strategy for any player and the best choice is to act randomly. But when randomization becomes the operative basis for economic choice, the most we can hope for is the generic prediction that outcomes will be randomly distributed. If information and change in it really have the role which I have described, then there is yet another reason to limit the aspirations of general equilibrium theory in particular to generic prediction and normative application. For it is well known that information obstructs an economy's attainment of optimal equilibria in several different ways. If this is so, then economic theory's commitment to the existence of such equilibria make it incapable of improvement in the direction of more and more specific predictions. But the role of information also enhances the normative role of economic theory in any attempt to attain such optimal equilibria. That is, it strengthens economic theory's claim to guide the construction of the social contract. Despite its crucial role in determining economic choice, information cannot, in fact, play the role of a commodity in the general equilibrium of a market economy. This is for at least two reasons, well known to economists. First, it is indivisible. Information is indivisible. In the absence of licensing agreements, the costs of acquiring information is independent of the scale of production in which it is used. Second, information is hard to appropriate. I can still use all of the information that I sell to you. The indivisibility of information leads to economies of scale incompatible with market clearing equilibria, while its inappropriability leads to non-optimal levels of information. No one has enough of an incentive to invest in producing new information if it can be bought from a discoverer and sold to other agents at a high enough rate to cover one's initial costs of buying the information instead of discovering it. For these reasons, and for others, Kenneth Arrow has noted, quote, it has become a classical position that a competitive world will underinvest in research and development because the information acquired will become general knowledge and cannot be appropriated by the firm financing the research." End of quote. Under those circumstances, and we know that there will not be a market clearing, provably optimal general equilibrium. Part four, is generic prediction enough? Given the role the changes in information play in determining economic behavior, and the problems it makes for neoclassical microeconomic theory, the normative moral and the positive moral should be apparent. It should be no surprise that a theory which cannot accommodate one of the most important variables determining the phenomena it is intended to explain is incapable of predicting the effects of changes in this variable. On the other hand, economic theory shows us the potential suboptimal consequences that changes in information can bring about in the sort of market economy we otherwise might endorse. Thus, it provides part of the normative argument in favor of taming information's suboptimal consequences by introducing institutions like copyrights or patent protection and intellectual property. for instance, that protect rational agents against the worst-case misuse of information by Hume's knave to his own advantage and the disadvantage of everyone else. How much predictive power does a theory need in order to have normative bearing on institution design? This is a question that I raised a while ago and said I would answer in a bit. Recall the reasons that Buchanan gives for adopting a prudential assumption that agents will be knaves, in Hume's term, self-seeking egoists. Buchanan gives us grounds to suggest that the most we need from economic theory for purposes of political philosophy is generic prediction. As Hume noted, here again I'll quote, "It is a maxim that in contriving any system of government and fixing the several checks and controls of the Constitution," end quote, "we should assume the worst case scenario, that every agent will seek only his own advantage. Because we cannot be sure how people will act, we wish to avoid the worst possible outcomes for ourselves, the outcome that ensues from selfishness, free riding, and non-cooperation. To do this, we need to identify the conditions which will produce the worst case outcome somewhere and some when, and then see to it that those conditions are prevented from obtaining. Generic prediction is all we need in order to obtain this end. It is a fact of life that the need to protect ourselves from worst-case consequences of rational egoism in others is rapidly increasing. In part, this is because more and more people have internalized the normative strictures of neoclassical theory to protect and to advantage themselves. As the stakes rise, both for individuals and the institutions they manage, incentives to adopt the theory of rational choice have increased very greatly. Problems in the provision of public goods, incentive compatibility, adverse selection, informational asymmetries in bargaining situations, these have all grown because people have become more and more rational in the neoclassical economist sense of that term. And they have done so because the incentives for gain and the risks for loss have grown. Part five, the last part, economic theory as applied mathematics. I've suggested that there is some reason to treat economic theory as part of political philosophy, in particular as an area of debate in social contract theory. This is a view which some economists might be eager to adopt, especially those preoccupied by welfare economics. But if they're inclined to find it too limited an area for the influence of their discipline, most economic theorists will insist that their discipline is a science, that their theories are the best and the most powerful economic and predictive devices there are among the social sciences. However, anyone with much knowledge of the history of economic theory will agree that the discipline does not seek or respond to empirical data in the way characteristic of an empirical science, even a theoretically impoverished one. If social contract theory is too Procrustean a bed for economic theory, and empirical science too demanding a status, is there not some other interpretation of the aims and methods of economic theory that will do full justice to its scope and its insulation from data? More than once, students of its subject have sought an interpretation of its aims and claims that reflects adequately its mathematical character. Both detractors and defenders of neoclassical orthodox economic theory have found its intellectual core in its mathematical expression. Let's explore this interpretation of economic theory as a branch of applied mathematics very briefly. To do so, compare the history of economic theory and geometric theory during the 19th century, the history of economic theory during the 19th and 20th century, and geometry during the 19th. Unlike physical theory, or for that matter the other social sciences, economic theory has been subject to exactly the same conceptual pigeonholing as geometry. Some have viewed it, with Sir Lionel Robbins of this institution, as a platonic body of intuitively obvious, idealized, but nevertheless correct descriptions of human behavior. Others, following Ludwig von Mises, have insisted that it is a Kantian body of synthetic a priori truths about rationality. Others, like the geometrical conventionalists and following T.W. Hutchison, have derided economic theory as a body of tautologies, as a pure system of implicit definitions without any grip on the real world. Still others, following John Stuart Mill, have held it to be a body of idealizations of roughly empirical regularities. Finally, some loosely following Milton Friedman have treated it as an uninterpreted calculus in the way positivists treated geometry. But most economists, like most geometers, have gone about their business of proving theorems and deriving results without giving much thought at all to the question of economic theory's cognitive status. For them, the really important question, the one which parallels the geometer's concern about the postulate of the parallels, the fifth of Euclid's postulates, was whether Walras's theorem that a general market clearing equilibrium exists, that it is stable and unique, and whether it follows from the axioms of economic theory. Just as geometers in the 19th century explored the ramifications of varying the strongest assumption of Euclidean geometry, the postulate of the parallels, economic theorists have devoted great energies to varying equally crucial assumptions in economic theory about the number of agents, their expectations, returns to scale and divisibilities, and determining whether a consistent economy, a market clearing equilibrium, will still result, will still be stable, and will be unique. Their interests in this formal result are quite independent of, indeed in spite of, the fact that its assumptions about production, distribution, and information are manifestly false. The proof of general equilibrium is the crowning achievement of mathematical economics. But just as geometry as a science faced a crisis in 1919, observations that confirmed, in the 1919 observations that confirmed the general theory of relativity, so economic theory faced a crisis in the evident fact of the Great Depression. For a long time after 1929, economists lost the conviction that the Walrasian general equilibrium was at least a state towards which markets must in the long run move. The main reaction to this crisis was, of course, Keynesianism. Insofar as this theory rests on a denial of the fundamental microeconomic assumption that economic agents' expectations are rational, that they do not suffer from money illusions, that they will tailor their actions to current and to future economic environments, Keynesian theory represented as much of a conceptual revolution in economics as non-Euclidean geometry did in geometry. Keynes, of course, did not entirely win the field. Even during the period when his theory appeared to explain why market clearing general equilibria might never be approached, let alone realized. One reason for this is that many economists, one reason that he didn't clear the field, is that many economists continued to be interested in the purely formal questions of conventional theory, quite regardless of its alleged irrelevance to understanding the actual world. These economists were implicitly treating the theory of rational choice as a purely axiomatic system whose terms may or may not be instantiated in the real world, but which is of great interest, like Euclidean geometry, whether or not its objects actually exist. More crucially for the history of economic theory, there never was and is not yet a theory which can play a role for economic theory like the role played for geometry by physical theory. Physics enabled us to choose between alternative applied geometries and to explain the deviations from actual observation of the ones we reject. There is no such theory to serve as an auxiliary in any choice between any applied economic equilibrium theory and a Keynesian equilibrium theory, for example. When in the 1970s, Keynesian theory foundered on the empirical facts of joint unemployment and inflation, empirical facts as unremitting as was the fact of the apparent non-market clearing unemployment equilibrium of the 30s, the result among economists, among many economists, was an eager return to the traditional theory. I have in mind the rational expectations theorists. Economic theorists have not forgotten the Great Depression, but their interest in it seems to be limited to showing that, after all, the Walrasian approach is at least logically compatible with it, something Keynes's earliest opponents could have vouchsafed them. In short, the theory and its development have been as insulated from empirical influences as geometry ever was before Einstein. All this suggests that, like geometry, economic theory may be viewed as a branch of mathematics somewhere on the intersection between pure and applied axiomatic systems. Much of the mystery surrounding the actual development of economic theory, its shift in formalism, its insulation from empirical assessment, its interest in proving purely formal abstract possibilities, its unchanged character over a period of a century, the controversies about its cognitive status, all of these things can be comprehended and properly appreciated if we give up the notion that economic theory has the aim of making empirical claims about human behavior. Instead, we might, with advantage, view it as a branch of mathematics, one devoted to examining the formal properties of a set of axioms about the transitivity of abstract relations, axioms that implicitly define a technical notion of rationality, just as geometry examines the formal properties of abstract points and lines. The abstract term rationality may have far more potential interpretations than economists themselves have realized, but rather less bearing on actual human behavior and its consequences than we have unreasonably demanded economics reveal. Indeed, treated as a body of pure research and shorn of its intended interpretation, parts of general equilibrium theory and game theory have begun to have an impact well beyond economics. In biology, again, there's a parallel to apparently useless 19th century research on non-Euclidean geometry, which in the 20th century proved essential to the general theory of equilibrium. The formalisms and the results of general equilibrium theory are turning out to have applications to establishing stability conditions for ecosystems undreamed of by the economists who proved the existence of uniqueness and stability theorems in economics. Their results, the economists' results, are being taken over and reinterpreted by mathematical ecology. Stripped of their intentional interpretation, they provide proofs and stability conditions for unique, stable equilibria that modern evolutionary biology requires in the development of its own theory of balance and competition in the evolution of the biosphere. Indeed, when recognized as a part of contractarian political philosophy, rational choice and conditions of general equilibrium have emerged as crucial tools of the sociobiologist. Sociobiology hopes to explain how norms of cooperation have emerged as stable equilibria among agents acting so as to maximize genetic fitness, or its short-sighted single-generation surrogate, ordinal preference. The way you maximize your genetic fitness is by maximizing your ordinal preference, or those of your immediate kin. The possibility of free riding and the consequent failure to provide public goods at optimal levels has daunted sociobiological speculation about the emergence of culture. If the rational choice theorist can show that rational agents would choose other regarding outcomes, cooperative outcomes, as maximizing ones, then both some forms of contractarianism and some forms of Darwinism about cultural evolution will have been vindicated. These results are a payoff hardly anyone could have expected. Interestingly, they reflect the compatibility of viewing economic theory both as an a priori discipline, a normative discipline, and an a priori mathematical discipline, and an exercise in contractarian political philosophy. For the most powerful results to be hoped for in this area are proofs that a particular socially desirable strategy commends itself to a thoroughgoing fitness or utility maximizer. But such a proof would by no means show that the strategy actually emerged because it maximized fitness. Nothing could convert such a possibility into a confirmed account of how sociality actually emerged, for the fossil record preserves no relevant evidence. The result is always at most the demonstration of an abstract possibility, a suggestive piece of applied mathematics. Can we expect more of a payoff of pure general equilibrium theory, or for that matter more from the derivation of theorems about strategies and parametric and strategic games? The question is no harder and no easier to answer than the equivalent answer in mathematics and political philosophy. Can we expect payoffs in mathematics? Can we expect them from contractarian political philosophy? Yes, of course we can. Can we say in advance what they are, where they will come from, and when? Emphatically not. Is this the slightest reason either to deny import to political philosophy or to mathematics, or to suggest that attention should not continue to be lavished on both of them? No. Mutatis mutandis for economic theory. For it may be that it is by the standards of these disciplines that we should measure the cognitive status of economic theory and its improvements. Thank you. On time and under budget.
I was just going to say that you predicted that it would last 60 minutes and you hit it spot on, the most accurate and precise prediction.
Of human behavior.
I'd like to thank you for that very lucid and rather devastating talk. And you've invited us to ask questions, and I wonder if there's anybody who would like to start the ball rolling. We've got some mobile microphones to make any question more audible, and if you do manage to get hold of one, would you speak directly into it? Professor Cartwright.
Alex, you started by talking about the empirical inadequacy of economics, and I thought that the argument about using economics about its playing a normative role really required a little more filling in of the reasons why economics is empirically inadequate in the first place. I think, for instance, that if the argument is to be at all compelling, I mean not knock down, drag out, but just even to have the beginnings of conviction, that there are a whole lot of questions about empirical adequacy of the, as it were, idealized theory that one wants to be able to answer. I mean, questions like, I can just sort of start running down a whole list of them, but questions like, for instance, how well the theoretical concepts of your ideal economic theory, which is going to predict for you what would happen in the worst case scenario and what kind of constraints you should build in, how well do the theoretical concepts that are used in that theory match with the kind of behaviors that one is worried about? I mean, you've got theoretical concepts like expectations, preferences, rationality, but Hume's concept of a knave, right, is a very informal concept, and it's really a matter of empirical adequacy, how much of the one matches the other. Or, secondly, one wants to be sure that what the economic theory, the ideal one, says predicts to happen if we all behaved maximally selfishly is what would happen if we all behaved maximally selfishly. And again, that seems to me a question of empirical adequacy and a, you know, not existent but a counterfactual empirical adequacy. Or we'd like to know that the constraints, we'd like to have an answer to another empirical question, which is like, for instance, we're thinking of imposing constraints or building institutional structures, and those are going to be the structures, the market, that are supposed to be appropriate or reasonable or best if everyone were to act like a knave. But we're pretty certain that, as a matter of fact, everyone isn't going to act like that, and it seems, again, an empirical question of how far the appropriate constraints deviate. I mean, whether it's one of those cases where if everyone acts a little bit like a knave, the constraints are pretty good, or whether it's one of those cases where, you know, you're not zeroing in on what would happen in reality when you're not exactly at that point. And so on and so on and so on. So the real question is, how can one use take your line that it might be used normatively without having much better assurances about its empirical adequacy?
It's a crucial part of my argument that for its normative use, the most we need to demand of economic theory is what I've called generic predictions. And naturally, it's an assumption that I make that economic theory is not empty, at least to the extent that it can provide such normative predictions. We all know, there's a famous story about someone who came to Lausanne to give a lecture at the university, and Pareto was in the audience, and Pareto dressed like a vagrant, rather. And the visiting lecturer insisted there were no economic laws. Quite stridently and vigorously, at some length, and at the end of the lecture, he was leaving the hall, and Pareto came up to him, and looking rather like a vagrant, he wasn't taken seriously by the lecturer, and Pareto laid a hand on the lecturer and said, "Excuse me, sir, can you tell me where I can get a free lunch?" And the man looked at him witheringly and said, "There are no free lunches." A cautionary tale to those of us who want to deny that there are economic laws. But the point of the story, as I tell it, of course, is that we can at least be assured that there will be responses to changes of the sort that economics tells us. If the cost of coffee increases, the demand for milk will decrease.
Look, I realize the structure of the argument goes like that, you need a qualitative result.
Now, how much,
yes,
by way of generic results, do you need in order for economic theory to have a normative grip, I think, is a difficult question. It seems clear to me that economic theory has normative predictive consequences. Okay? It seems clear to me also that it is by some study of economic theory that we can actually improve constitutional arrangements, institutional design. But exactly to what level we need such generic predictions will be a function of the detail of the demands that we place on the economic theory. Suppose that you adopt a market on the strength of an economist's argument about the optimal use of information, and then you discover that it's non-optimal in certain ways. You discover, for example, what Hobbes probably hadn't thought of, that there were collective goods problems. Okay? Now, what do you do? The economist undertakes a study of the response of rational agents to the market failure in the provision of public goods. Okay? The study that the economist undertakes is a relatively formal one. Okay? Coase's theorem or something like that. Now the question becomes, what are the payoffs here in going back to redesign our institutions in order to solve this problem of the commons? I think that it's no more a matter of sheer inference what this payoff is in this case than it is in other cases. We'd have to look and see whether the generic predictions of the economic theory that the public good will be provided at adequate levels under the terms recommended by the economist actually are borne out. If they are, well and good. If they're not, the economist needs to go back as a member of the design team for the public institution and tinker some more.
Look, the reason I gave the particular list I gave, though, was because they seem to me, I mean, I realized from part four of your paper and elsewhere that you do value the qualitative or generic predictions, but I just seem to me that when you start thinking about the kinds of questions of what happens when you're far from the ideal, how you know what happens, and how well the theoretical concepts fit, that we're getting into an area where we need to have some methodology for figuring out whether the generic predictions are in the right ballpark at all.
I guess it seems very clear to me that the concepts don't fit, that the fundamental assumptions of neoclassical economic theory about the way agents take decisions are so far from the actual way in which agents take decisions that the question of their empirical adequacy in this sense is clear and is to be answered in the negative. What we know from cognitive psychology, from economists like Akerlof have internalized into their own theory, suggests to us that there's very little empirical adequacy in these concepts. Now, if by empirical adequacy you mean what, say, Bas van Frassen means, or philosophers who hold that all we can expect or all we ought to expect of a theory is empirical adequacy, then it's clear enough what I'm saying. I'm saying that the theory has damn little empirical adequacy. So I guess I need to understand a little more fully what you mean when you ask what the empirical adequacy of the fundamental concepts of the theory is. Do they reflect the way in which individual agents take decisions? I think the answer to that is no.
I have a question up there.
Well, I think that it is a pity that you have chosen to criticize a straw man as opposed to the real thing. I think that I'm afraid that your lecture contains plenty of misunderstandings about what contemporary economic theory is about. For the sake of brevity, let me just make three comments on your lecture. First, economic theory cannot be reduced to general equilibrium theory, to competitive general equilibrium theory. In fact, almost all the exciting developments in economic theory in the last 20 years have been outside the realm of competitive general equilibrium theory. In fact, we spend almost no time teaching general equilibrium theory in our graduate courses at the LSE. Second,
more power to you.
Economic theory is not really, in my view, concerned with prediction, but with understanding about economic phenomena. So the lack of predictive power is largely irrelevant from the point of view of the evaluation of what economic theory is. Finally, I think that even at the empirical level, economic theory has been extremely successful, I would say hugely successful, in explaining a lot of things. And I think that from my perspective, which obviously is that of an economist and one that does economic theory, I think that you should really look at what economists do as opposed to what you think that, what you are thinking that they do.
I think your third point, although widely believed by economists, is also disbelieved by some economists and a matter of very great debate. And it's extremely difficult for a philosopher to enter this debate with much credibility because not only does the debate very soon become one of yes it is, no it isn't, but you have the standing and I don't. If you were to expatiate on Hume's theory of causation, I would probably take exception. And I recognize that it is a matter of some temerity on my part to claim that economic theory has not been the success which you say it has. It is important to bear in mind that in this talk, I spoke consistently about economic theory and not about economics. Economic theory is one part of economics, and of course I don't have to tell you how small a part of economics economic theory is. The second point that you made is one that is clearly within the purview of my discipline, the question about what the connection is between prediction and understanding. There was a line in my paper which wasn't a throwaway but was an invitation to take up a challenge, and I'll take you as having raised it. Seems to me that there's got to be a difference between seeming, between having the feeling that one understands something, between the psychological repose the reduction of curiosity and really understanding something. Now, what could the difference between thinking you understood something and really understanding it come to? I'm afraid that my view is fairly old-fashioned about this. I believe that ultimately the difference between merely thinking you understand something and really understanding it is having some predictive knowledge on the basis of your assumed understanding. If you can't predict the outcome of an event or of a process, then I think that you are very far from understanding it. And even if you feel in your bones very confident that you understand it, but that understanding provides you with no predictive payoff, direct or indirect, then I think that you haven't accepted the responsibility of establishing that your understanding is any more than a subjective psychological repose. First point that you made, economic theory is not general equilibrium theory. I have great difficulty dealing with that response. It's a very convenient line to take when general equilibrium theory is under attack. And yet it's very hard to see what the intellectual foundations of comparative statics are, for example, if they aren't in general equilibrium theory. If you do a comparative statics analysis on the blackboard, you're assuming that there is sufficient stability in the economic process so that when the price of one commodity is changed, The price of all the other commodities isn't. Now, what kind of assurance do we have of that? Well, we have the assurance of empirical adequacy. We just watch the change in one price doesn't change every other price. That's clearly not sufficient for economists. Economists generally want a more theoretical justification of this conviction of theirs. And that justification comes in general equilibrium theory. Sometimes inconvenient, I think, for economists that general equilibrium theory has the role that it does in economic theory. And maybe this is one of those occasions. But I think that you do yourself a disservice to deny the centrality of this really quite wonderful intellectual achievement to the character of your discipline. Have I covered all three of your points?
Right. I wanted just to make a comment and turn it then into a question. At the beginning of your talk, you sort of compared economics with physics in a way. So physics is the kind of science which makes all these nice predictions, and economics may fall short of that. But the comment is that the kind of a clockwork image of physics, these are really the, in many ways, the exceptions. Physics isn't really, it's more like the clouds, to use sort of Popperian analogy. But the reason why a prediction failed in physics happens for three or four different reasons, and my question will be whether there's any analogy between these reasons and what's going on in economics. I mean, the first reason is you may just not be able to collect enough data. I mean, in relativistic theories, there are very good reasons why you can't do that. You just can't get the data in fast enough. The second general reason is, in general relativity, for example, you just may not have a well-posed initial value problem. It just may mathematically not exist. Ironically, as against Laplace, even for n particles, gravitating particles in general, the initial value problem can't be posed.
Three-body problem.
Well, then, of course, there's chaotic systems. Even if you knew the data, you have to know them with infinite precision, and all you can generally get with chaotic systems is just what you call generic predictions, just the locations of strange attractors, that kind of thing. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of indeterminism, where you just may not, again, for quite a different reason, be able to make predictions. So all sorts of reasons why, generically in physics, the inability to predict is much more widespread than the simple kind of clockwork image, if you like. And I wonder whether any of those sort of rather well-known reasons for the failure of prediction in physics does find an analogy in economics. And also, my final point would be that this doesn't mean in situations where you can't make predictions, you can't do good physics or good science. You may be able to classify phenomena post hoc, maybe explain them, and go into all kinds of scientific understanding of what's going on. And the issue of prediction may be a little bit of a red herring in physics as well as in economics.
It is probably the case that all of the factors that you identify as undermining the prospects for prediction in physics obtain in economics and the social sciences, with the exception of the last one. The indeterminism of quantum mechanics is something that I think can't be part of the explanation in the social sciences, and that's simply because when you've aggregated to the level of even the macromolecule, you have asymptotically approached deterministic physics. And certainly, even the indeterminism of statistical mechanics and thermodynamics isn't intractable in the way that, say, quantum mechanics is intractable. But it's certainly going to be the case that there will be predictive weaknesses in economics that parallel the predictive impoverishment of say, statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. Would that economics approached even the level of predictive precision of phenomenological thermodynamics. But I'm inclined to say that the sources of predictive weakness in economics and the social sciences are largely of two kinds. One, we can't improve our measurements of the values of the causal variables because they are part of what philosophers call an intentional circle. That is, You can't establish the an individual agent's preferences without knowing his actions or and his expectations. You can't establish her expectations without knowing her actions and her preferences. You can't establish the actions without knowing both the preferences and the expectations. But of course, to the extent that economic theory, macroeconomic theory, or any macro-social theory is agnostic about the causes of individual behavior, this couldn't be part of the prediction, part of the explanation of predictive weakness in these theories. Well, I'm inclined to say macro theories are not likely to be hobbled in the way that micro theories of human behavior are. For a variety of reasons, we do not yet have very good macroeconomic theories or macro theories in most disciplines. I think when we start to have them, and probably first in demography, they will prove to be increasingly powerful in their predictive content. I think in any theory which does take individual choice seriously, in addition to the intentional circle of variables, I think the other serious limitation on prediction must come from the character of information and from the fact that there are information shocks. Information is exogenous in most theories. Even when a piece of information is internalized, by the time it's worked its way through to the sort of outcome that we want to predict, another piece of information has come in and affected the trajectory established by the initial piece of information. And if that was less of a problem at one time, it will become increasingly a problem over time. To that extent, I think theories that take micro motives seriously are likely forever to be predictively weak. But now, your last point, I think, is one where you are making common cause with the economist in the balcony. You say that there are many things that are done in physics, for example, that don't have a particularly important predictive payoff, but nevertheless constitute serious scientific advance. Well, in one sense, of course, you're right, okay? But I want to say that in another sense, you're not right, because even when you successfully classify something, the basis on which your classification will have turned out to be correct must ultimately be predictive. You see a photograph from the business end of a linear accelerator, and you say, oh, this is proton decay, or some more expected outcome. You classify it in a certain way. You're implicitly making a commitment about future interactions recorded in future photographs. You're also going to make use of this thus classified picture in some further application. You are implicitly making a wide variety of different predictions, and if they turn out to not be borne out by subsequent experiments, you go back and toss out that bit of classification. Now, I think it would be a serious objection to my view if you could find me some piece of clear scientific achievement that doesn't have a direct or indirect connection with prediction. But I'd like to go on to say that I recognize that we understand prediction, we philosophers of science understand prediction no better than our predecessors, the positivists, did. I mean, the positivists had a cottage industry of problems of understanding prediction. Hempel showed us that we didn't know what a positive instance was. And Goodman showed us that we couldn't tell the difference between saying something was going to be grew or green now or in the year 2000. And then there are the problems associated with having any kind of an observational language in which to express the predictive consequences of a theory. I recognize that these are all very serious problems. And the most I want to say about predictive improvement is this, that a scientific theory should, in the long run, that period of time in which Keynes said we're all dead, should in the long run provide predictive improvement. That's a very weak demand on scientific theory and on scientific explanation, and that's why I'm inclined to make it, even though I don't know what a positive instance is and I can't solve Goodman's new riddle of induction.
Well, thank you very much. But just one last comment. Of course, the most sort of glaring examples in physics where we get the failure prediction is the endemic occurrence of singularities in general relativity, the sort of Hawking-Penrose-type theorem. And there, what the explanation is of why you can't make the prediction, namely the occurrence of the singularities. So in a certain way, it does have explanatory power, but it's explanatory power to explain why you can't make the prediction. So that's a slightly ironic twist, perhaps, but perhaps a point just worth making.
Let me make one point in response to that. In cosmological theory, when one attempts to understand a singularity, one doesn't make predictions about that singularity, but the theory on the basis of which one understand the singularity is a theory that is replete with predictions of other kinds.
Sure.
And it is those other predictions that provide the test that convinces one that one has real understanding here as opposed to merely the subjective reduction of curiosity.
Sure. Well, it was right that you should have the last word there. It remains for me to say what a very clear and provocative talk we all found it. Some will have agreed and some disagreed, but from my vantage point, I could see that you held the attention of everybody very, very firmly. And I'd like to thank you and ask you all to thank our speaker for a really marvellous talk. And I remind you that the presentation of the Lakatos Award is on the fifth floor in the senior common room.